Thank you for joining me as always. So let's go ahead and dive right into it. I did, you know, I started out the day actually watching this anti-Ron DeSantis ad that made me like him more than anything else that I've seen. But it was funny because those on the left were going on about, I mean, they tried to make him look bad by stating his own words, which was things like, people have the right to make their own choices. And we were supposed to be somewhat aghast at that. And I just find it kind of weird how it's like the sort of the left and the right, or the free-loving and those who hate freedom at this point, are just so kind of diametrically opposed now that you can both look at the same ad and come away with a very different view of things, right? And that's what I saw with that Ron DeSantis ad. It's like the whole thing goes through him basically saying, you know, we care about people's freedoms, we care about people's rights, and we trust people to make the choices that, you know, make the most sense for them and their families. And it's like, okay, so you've got this one reasonable guy. And those on the left saw the same ad and were aghast that he had said those things. And further, acted like, you know, he was some kind of murderer for caring about people's rights and freedoms and their willingness to, you know, run their own businesses. And it was just kind of, I don't know, perplexing to me, I guess, that we could look at the same thing and come to such staggeringly different conclusions. Anyway, let's go ahead, and I'd like to talk to you, actually, about the January 6th protest again, I know. But this is the case of a gentleman who was being charged for his appearance at the protest, and he was being charged entirely unfairly, regardless of how you look at the whole event. And he has died. He died awaiting trial, which it's been falsely reported that he was actually in jail, you know, and awaiting trial there, because there are a lot of people who were incarcerated for long periods of time, and I think some who still are, which is shocking. But in any case, that wasn't the case with him. So it's actually a guy named John Anderson, and there he is. And he died, but, you know, he was falsely accused and falsely prosecuted. He was a former Marine, a small business owner, a conservative, and he showed up, you know, responding to then President Trump's call to show up and, you know, protest and seek a fair election, you might say, or a look into the election. That was what it was actually about, right? That was the Stop the Steal protest and so on. He showed up there, and because he showed up, he was treated, frankly, awfully. And so I want to talk about this case, because his lawyer, Marine Medvin, has been able to come out now, since the case is over, since he died, and basically give us the details of what really was going on. Because, you know, lawyers don't want to talk about the case while the case is still active, but the case is now no longer active, given that he died. So he went there for the protest, and he didn't attack anyone. But he was charged with assaulting police officers and with stealing police equipment, those being, you know, police shields and so on. But none of that was true. And it turned out that basically he was afflicted by pepper spray whilst he was there in the crowd. And it was actually someone in the crowd who first sprayed him, because they were apparently trying to, you know, spray in the direction of police. And he was basically between the police and the rest of the crowd. And after he got sprayed, well, then the police also sprayed in, and he was in this, you know, big tunnel, and he ended up having severe breathing difficulties. He was a person who had asthma and also a heart condition, and he suddenly found himself unable to breathe. And there's video footage of him saying, I can't breathe, and him, you know, holding toward his chest, and he's basically down on the ground at that point. So what he ended up doing is sort of moving toward the front of the line, and then police grabbed him and pulled him into the Capitol to give him medical aid. Now, he accredited those cops who did that with saving his life. But then he was charged afterward with assaulting a police officer. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But this is one of those cases, right, that's been kind of blown up by the media as proof. Like, because some people were charged with assaulting police officers, therefore, you know, that sort of stuff had to happen, or did happen, and all these charges are basically implicitly true, right? And instead, that's not what we see when we actually look at the facts in these cases. In this case, there's no way he assaulted a police officer. In fact, the lawyer in the case was seeking video footage from the prosecutor, saying, okay, you've got the whole thing, you know, on video, So show us the footage where John attacks the cop. They didn't have any. To the contrary, the video showed him being there in the crowd and then falling to the ground, struggling to breathe, because that's what actually happened. And they still did not drop the charges. Instead, they were trying to get him to plead guilty to a felony, to a charge that would end up with, I think, a maximum of 5 years of prison time. And he refused to, saying that he wouldn't admit to something that he hadn't done. He would not say that he was guilty of something that he wasn't guilty of. And for that reason, he, you know, fought off and refused to take the plea agreement, despite the pretty massive charges against him. I mean, assault with a police officer is pretty serious, along with stealing federal equipment, which was the shield, which, by the way, wasn't federal. It was actually, you know, from the local police department. But that was, you know, something that the lawyer, an attorney, had to kind of figure out and press them on, because they were just making up charges and trying to make things as bad as possible in order to convince him to plead guilty to this felony. And that's what's really going on in these cases, is you've got people who were just there, right, or just walked through a building, but they're getting levied with all these different charges such that they plead guilty to things that they weren't guilty of, because they're so afraid of getting like 20 years in prison and being, you know, having their lives destroyed, which is what the media wants to happen, because the media describes these people as domestic terrorists and so on, right? And instead, it's an evil prosecution or even a persecution that's going on that doesn't match what actually happened. And as far as the shield incident, in any case, it touched him, but he at no point stole anybody's shield. It was passed over his head. He was getting medical aid. You know, it's like, it just should show you exactly how these sorts of cases actually work. What's really going on in the supposed justice system, because there's nothing just about any of that. You know, that's not a justice system that any of us would recognize, I don't think. All right, hold on. Tom says, assaulting a police officer when they were burning down our country in 2020, though, wasn't a crime. Well, yeah, that happened all the time. In fact, I remember the cases in which the leftists, from Antifa to Black Lives Matter, I don't really feel a need to make a big distinction there, were using those high-powered lasers to try and blind the cops permanently, some of whom did in fact get permanent damage. And yet, in case after case, the charges were dropped. And that happened in a really big way after the Biden administration took over, because if you remember, it was toward the end of Trump's administration, when they started to sort of deputize a lot of the people, all of the officers over in Portland, and make them into basically federal officers, so that the Trump administration could charge these people who were repeatedly acting in areas of, well, they were acting as felons, let's say. They were being aggressive and burning down federal buildings and so on. So that happened, and then these people were actually charged. Well, then the Biden administration ended up taking over in January, and all those charges were dropped by those federal officers because the Biden administration didn't actually want to prosecute those people. And it's not just Biden, of course, because let's be honest, he's just a figurehead anyway. You also had, of course, the Kamala Harris, who had made her intentions pretty clear before then when she'd encouraged people to donate toward bail funds for the people who hadn't yet committed crimes. Right, that was the Antifa bail fund for people who would commit crimes in the future so they could then get bailed out later on. I mean, that's something, you know. It's one thing to look at a case and say, okay, this person needs to get bail, needs to be released, needs to be returned to his or her family or whatever. Now, that's one thing. But when you actually pay beforehand, you're actually basically encouraging a person to commit a crime at that point. You're almost paying them to commit the crime, it could certainly be argued. You know, if I pay a person, you know, and say, here's some money, you're not going to have to deal with the consequences of your actions. I'll just, you know, pay you for it. I'm the one basically committing the crime in that instance. And I think most people would argue so too. But that's the system that we live in. Scribbler Squire says, did Trump have the opportunity to pardon the January 6th protesters? He could have. He wasn't in there for long before he left, like on the 20th. He could have at least some of them, but probably not most, to be fair. The thing that bothers me, though, is the fact that he stayed quiet on a lot of those people until basically, I think it was July of this year when he started really talking about those people. So yeah, it was July. It was he waited a really long time to mention the protesters and to mention their unfair treatment, and he mentioned Ashley Babbitt at the same time. I believe that was in July, and that's something that I brought up repeatedly. Why isn't he talking about these people? In fact, to the contrary, I think it was January 7th, the very next day, when he talked about how those people had, trampled on, I think it was the shrine of our democracy, something to that effect. It was also the pillar of the democracy too. It changed around for that week. But basically, those who showed up to support him were bad. That was the bottom line. And then what the people that he did pardon were rappers and the Israeli spy and several corrupt politicians, including Democrat politicians. He pardoned them. He didn't pardon the January 6th people, and he didn't pardon Julian Assange. So yeah, don't get me started on the people who didn't pardon. But yeah, and the fact that he went on for so much about the defilement of the Capitol, which was the talking point of the Democrats. I mean, seriously, that was the narrative that they were building at that time. And then he just went along with it, like, that suddenly made sense. And this is something that Conservative Inc. always does, by the way, is they take the narrative of the left as is. They won't build their own story, including based upon truth, because you are, you know, when you're reporting something in this way, you're presenting a story, and that's what I mean. They always accept the one of the Democrats, as if the Democrats themselves have either some kind of allegiance to truth, or something to that effect. I mean, seriously, it doesn't make any sense. But they act like the Democrats either have an allegiance to truth or some kind of moral superiority. And as long as they're doing that, we're not going to have any sort of meaningful change because, I mean, why would you? Richard Tarth, for all the reasons you state, we have to get rid of the current politicians, especially the Democrats, before they put free thinkers in jail. Well, I'm pretty sure they're working on it. And I think in this country, there's a little bit of an impediment in that there is, you know, a constitution for now, sort of, you know, it's constantly being trampled. I do get that. Don't take me wrong here. But I do think it has slowed their willingness to do more. Like, for example, if we didn't have, you know, the First Amendment, I have no doubt whatsoever that things would be a lot worse than they are. But it's going to change over time as they start putting the same exceptions towards speech that they do toward, you know, like firearms, for example. They're like, well, you have a right to bear arms, but not if that arm is, you know, can take more than 10 bullets or something like that. You know, they just start putting those things in. And it's like, well, if you can redefine the right to bear arms in that manner, then why can't you also say, well, you have the right to speak freely, but not to say something that offends someone else, which is the basis of the hate speech argument that you see throughout academia. For example, and when you see it throughout academia, you'll shortly see it in American culture and especially in American politics. They kind of take root like little cancers inside academia and then spread from there further on down into our political cesspit. That's basically what happens. Kyle DeFranco, welcome to the show tonight. He says, Republican politicians are either leftists or want the approval of the left. Yes. Now, Trump seemed like an exception to that back in 2016, and then gradually fell toward in the direction of the swamp as he kind of surrounded himself with the advisors that were from the swamp. Okay. In any case, let's move on for now. I do want to talk about a case in which Baltimore is refusing the right of a Catholic group called Church Militant to rally. You've probably seen Church Militant on YouTube or basically around online. In any case, they wanted to hold a rally outside the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in protest, and to do so on November 16th. And the city of Baltimore says that they can't. Now, the reason this interests me as a topic is because the reason that Baltimore said, no, you can't protest. See, the reason was because Church Militant at one point, apparently, encouraged the January 6th protesters. That's the reason. And so Baltimore then extrapolated and said, well, that means that you're basically domestic terrorists, and therefore you don't have the right to protest, and furthermore that violence is likely. They even went as far as literally Baltimore said that because Church Militant had questioned the election, that they also shouldn't have the right to protest. Now, I mean, so? I mean, seriously, on what basis should we say, okay, this one group has once said this thing, and let's just say that it was an offensive thing, which it's not, but even if it was something particularly offensive, I mean, on what basis does a US city have the right to say, no, you can't protest your own ideas because we don't like them? That's not the way that it's supposed to work. And it seems like, as far as I can tell, you know, off the top of my head here, it seems like Baltimore is basically refusing the group Church Militant every right that is protected by the First Amendment, right? Because you've got the right to free speech and free press and freedom of association and ability to, you know, petition the government for redress of grievances. Certainly free press, because the Church Militant is also a media organization. So it's kind of amazing that you can have Baltimore that can be so incredibly aggressive in stomping on someone's rights. But I do think this is kind of somewhat futuristic, in the sense that this is what you're going to start looking at moving forward. You've got a US city that thinks that it makes perfect sense that you can look at a group and say, well, this group once associated with Trump, because remember, that was Trump's rally. It wasn't just some random, you know, rally over in DC. It was organized by Trump. It was him who announced it multiple times on his Twitter feed and so on. And you've got a city who wants to say, okay, on the basis of your kind of association with Trump at one time, and on your association with a prior protest, we're going to deny you all of your rights. And if you accept their most aggressive argument, which is that it's likely to be violent, which is just hogwash, seriously, there's like no chance that rally would be violent. But in any case, even if you accept that it's likely to be violent on the basis that these people supported January 6th protesters, also, so what? And I say that because it's like, you can't deny people the right to speak freely because you think some people in the crowd might get appropriately worked up, or inappropriately worked up. Like, police can't prevent crimes, for example. That's not a thing. You can't refuse protests because some people might get upset. It's their job, you might say, to keep the peace, you know, to do what they can to show up, you know, and they can make themselves seen or what have you, or they can arrest people who actually commit crimes. But you can't simply say, no, you don't have a right to speak simply because we say so. Some groups are more equal than others. Yeah, I hear you. Trump was suspended on Twitter before that rally. Well, he was suspended on Twitter after the January 6th rally, on the same day when he was telling people to go home and remember the day forever, but not to engage with police officers and not to be violent. Trump uploaded a video of himself saying that, you know, go home, remember this day forever. And he was kind of, there was some like sense of camaraderie between him and those protesters. And for that reason, Twitter didn't like it and they took it down. But the thing was, that was him telling people to go home and not to be violent. So it's like, if anything, Twitter actually encouraged the violence or the entering of the Capitol, which is more like what actually happened, because it wasn't really particularly a violent incident in any case. But Twitter encouraged it by taking down the person who could have told those people to go home, because what actually happened on the ground then was people amongst the crowd started saying, well, Trump said to go home, and then people went and looked and they didn't see anything, so they stayed and didn't go home. That was Twitter's decision that resulted in that. It's ridiculous. Okay, anyway. Who suspended Trump? That was Twitter that suspended Trump. And then, of course, Facebook and every other big tech company silenced him for a while, some of them lightening up over time. But I think he was actually shocked that big tech was willing to take that approach. But why wouldn't they? Because that was after the election. They knew that he wasn't going to get reinstated. And so they felt that they could act sort of with impunity and silence the sitting president of the United States because he wouldn't be president for much longer. And honestly, I have to say that it seems that he sort of bears some responsibility for that, in the sense that people have been screaming at him for like 4 years at that point to do something about the big tech censorship that was happening with his own supporters, right? With people on the right of various types were being silenced, and that was having a really bad net effect on, frankly, society, where you can only have basically one side of the conversation is able to talk, right? He didn't do anything. He had his little meeting at the White House where he had all of the different, I guess you can say, more mainstream YouTube producers and video producers of all stripes. And everyone went over there and they sat and they had their little meeting where he promised them that he was going to do something. And then nothing happened. And you did have, I'm going to say four, but maybe more, different hearings with the people of big tech, where you had Ted Cruz there and Rand Paul kind of, frankly, grandstanding a bit about how bad these people are. But it's like, if they weren't willing to actually press charges when these people actually lied under oath, as we know that they did, then what's the point? At that point, it is just grandstanding. And instead, and one of the biggest things that I upset people with while Trump was still in office was, like, I think it was probably like halfway through his term, I think. And I did this video about this meeting that Trump had had with the CEO of Apple, his name, Tim Cook, right? And I was criticizing him for just sitting at this table, and he was basically having this great time with Tim Cook talking about infrastructure and all this. And it's like, okay, this is the guy who's censoring your people. And this is the guy who's giving speeches about how we won't stand for any hate speech on our platforms. And they were kicking off, you know, companies like Gab off of the App Store at Apple. And then Trump at the same time is like befriending him and doing the fist bumps and everything. And I found the whole thing kind of egregious, because it's like, well, as long as Trump isn't being censored, everything's fine. Well, a lot of people got upset at me because at that particular point in time, there was a lot more friendliness toward Trump. I was willing to criticize him pretty much when he did something wrong, in my estimation. So that kind of resulted in a bit of a rift in the audience, but I'll always tell you what I think, you know, regardless of what it is. Then he had the, later on, I think he had the dinners with Zuckerberg too, where they were fist bumping themselves and talking about fighting the censorship or whatever. It was really ridiculous, it was. So when it really came down to it, and it's January 6th and 7th and 8th, and he's getting censored off all the different platforms, I was kind of conflicted, like, okay, so now you know how your supporters feel. And I will say I felt some degree that way, as the Democrats have been looking for different ways to prosecute him too. Like, it was, you know, he waited until the last minute to issue pardons for any of his closest friends, who hadn't done anything wrong and who were just being, like, people like Roger Stone, who were just being railroaded, without due cause. It's like, okay, but if you won't, you know, look after the people who are being persecuted strictly because of your affiliation, then kind of what good are you, you know? It's like, have some sense of loyalty and decency there, you know? All right, let me get a drink. Carl DeFranco says, Republicans can't do anything about internet censorship because they worship the golden calf of private companies. And private companies is in quotes. Well, they could and still maintain intellectual consistency if they wanted to, because none of these companies are private companies. And I've been saying that. They're not. I mean, we call them private companies, but these are companies that get government grants, in some cases state government, but also federal government grants, to do various things that smaller companies that would compete with them in a real free market do not get. And so you would think that in the very least, the Republicans who wanted to make the free market argument, or the private company argument, as you call it, they could make that approach. They could say, well, these companies actually aren't private companies, and they should be treated as the government entities that they basically are. And that means that they should be required to actually, you know, uphold the rights of the citizens who use them if they're going to get these government grants. And in reality, the only reason that they are so big, that they are so monopolist, you might say, is because of the money that they have received from the federal government that makes it impossible for any competing companies to do well. I mean, and you know, they get the government to give them money in various different ways, because it's not just the obvious grants and the money that they get from states to set up new headquarters, like the Amazon thing. You remember that? When Amazon's like, well, we're going to come up with a new headquarters, and you had all these different cities throughout the United States all promising millions of dollars in different things, you know, different bonuses. And it's like, okay, but what if a regular little company wanted to start there? All these politicians who are offering Amazon that money all talk about the small businesses and how much they care about them when it comes to election time. But now they're like, oh, here's this big business, you know, here's some money. And it's like, okay, is that what the voters would actually want? Is that what? No, it's not. Does that actually make for a free market? No. No, it actually doesn't. It undermines the free market and creates a sort of corporatist system that nobody wants to live in. And these very same companies then come around and they stomp on the rights of Americans. And these politicians who funded them with your money stay quiet in such an instance. Or at the very most, they speak out and then don't actually try and do anything to change it, which is the way politicians like to work, granted. But in any case, I do think a different approach could be taken and maintain the intellectual consistency of the kind of private companies argument, because they're not private companies in any real sense. There's also the fact that so many of these companies get money for the government in exchange for selling out your data. And that's something that I don't see talked about very much. But when it comes to fulfillment of not warrants, but simply requests by law enforcement or by simple government agencies, these companies can actually choose to agree to basically give out your information. And it's often in their privacy policies. Their privacy policies nowadays are like, you have no privacy, right? If we want to give your information over, we will. And that's what like Google and all these different companies are like. And then, so that's what they do. They basically sell it. They're like, okay, you don't have a warrant, so give us some money. And this actually happens. And so you end up with our tax money being used in that way too, in order to get your data. It's really, it's like when you think about it, it's so perverse, but it happens all the time. It happens constantly. Okay. Sorry, I'm a little hoarse tonight. And for anybody in the chat who's having trouble getting, you know, your comments censored by Google, just go over to DLive and it has another chat over there. I can see both chats from both places, just so you know. Okay. In any case, I will say though, I have gotten a bunch of threats recently. I've had like a new surge in threats come in from Muslims because, I did a video, it's been a while back, it's called Why Moroccan Women Know Their Place, and it was sort of satirical because it was this joke that wasn't supposed to be a joke. There was this piece on TV in Morocco about how to cover up your bruises with makeup, and of course that's an Islamic place, and I found that particularly amusing, and so I covered the whole issue in that video. And suddenly there's been like a new reinterest in that particular video, and I've had some threats on that, which I've, you know, I found it amusing because I was criticizing the religion of peace, of course. Well, it's kind of ties into what's going on over in the, not Morocco, but still we'll call it the third world, like Afghanistan, for example. Anywhere where Islam exists, I'll just go ahead and call the third world. You can see how much I respond to threats. So apparently recently over in Kabul, which everyone knows about now because of the way that Biden handled the withdrawal from Afghanistan, well, six women decided to gather at this high school in Kabul to demand the right of schools to go back to high school because the Taliban had decided that girls shouldn't get a secondary education, and really not much of a lower education either. But the Taliban prohibited that weeks ago, and that ended up getting the reaction that you might expect. A foreign journalist was hit with a rifle. They were prevented from filming this six-person protest. I imagine I know why only six people showed up, because the rest of them weren't willing to. Gunshots were shot in the air, and the protest was ended, and the signs were taken away. So, yeah, It just kind of reminds me of the whole... The thing is, with the Morocco video, the Muslims who responded to it and who were being particularly threatening were also simultaneously saying that Islam is not anti-women, which was particularly amusing. It's like, you know, I'm going to kill you, and also we have the religion of peace. There's just something that they just don't seem to see, the kind of disconnect there, apparently. Who knows why? In a country that is supposed to be first world, but isn't, namely Britain, it turns out that the UK Ministry of Defence is beginning to spy on social media. So basically you've got the military now being used to look at the citizens and what they're typing out in order to detect a change in what they call population sentiment. Yeah, so since COVID, the British military have kind of started to turn its attention inward against the British citizenry as opposed to outward to protect against actual threats, you know, like Islamic ones like we were just talking about. Yes, the Muslims watching this show are going to be so happy. One of them demanded that I wear a hijab. I'll get right on that, you know, later, of course. But in any case, back on topic, sorry, I just kind of threw that off. In any case, the military's main adversaries now, as it turns to the British military, are the British citizens who complain about lockdowns while questioning the efficacy and safety of vaccines and so on. So, yeah, it's like, you know, it's one thing when you have the police doing it, and granted, we know that to some degree the police are doing it. I guess maybe the British government are kind of feeling like they're falling behind because we've got like the NSA and everything constantly monitoring what's going on online in order to figure out changes in population sentiment, because you've got recently this mirrors what's going on with our military, because the Biden administration has been looking for ways to crack down on what they call extremism, right? Which is anything that's even remotely right-wing. Okay, that's the modern extremist. They're kind of redefining it. Like, they're redefining a lot of words. I don't know if you've noticed, you're keeping up with Merriam-Webster. You have to just keep up with that in order to figure out exactly what we can say and what we can't, and what means what. It's very Orwellian. It's like, I don't really know the meaning of words anymore, like vaccination and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, speaking of Kabul, though, there was that, I don't know if you've heard, but there was a Marine who rescued a baby over there, over the wall outside the airport, and then was later applauded and spoke very briefly at a Trump rally. The thing is that he spoke for 2 to 3 sentences at this Trump rally out of uniform, saying that he thought that was the best thing he'd ever done in his life, was rescue this baby. And that was about it. And he said that he was thankful he got home and was able to be here at the rally today. And he is now under investigation by the United States military. Now, he didn't say anything that represents the military. He didn't appear in uniform. There is literally nothing that he did that I can see that is wrong. I mean, seriously, you can't even justify or empathize with that. It's quite clear that he's been placed under investigation as a way to kind of silence other people. He's been placed under investigation for daring to appear with the former president of the United States, that being Trump. That's what's really going on. And it's like, as I was talking about earlier, you have a kind of crackdown on free speech that is actively happening. And it's especially happening inside of organizations that I find the most disturbing, right? It's happening inside of the military, it's happening inside of police, academia as well, but that's been going on a lot longer. I think certainly law enforcement and military efforts have dramatically increased. Matt says he was off duty. Yeah, exactly. He was off duty and out of uniform. And he wasn't pretending to represent the military in any respect. He was, you know, representing himself, talking about what he did, and that he was glad he was home. There's nothing that he did. I mean, because you've got these generals now who talk about how there's too much white rage, and you have to wonder if he's going to be finding himself subject to one of their programs that teaches soldiers about things like white rage. And I'm starting to hear these different reports of people being forced to listen to these kind of indoctrination programs. Now, this was actually happening under the Obama administration, where in a lot of the different areas of government to some degree, right? So I'm not just talking about the military, I'm talking about stuff like NASA and so on. They had these different courses that people were required to take, and also at Hughes, because it had like a military contractor, I heard about this. They were required to take them, and it was basically like a critical race theory style class where these people are taught about their privilege on the basis of their whiteness and how they should treat other people, basically as if white people are inferior beings and they should treat non-white people as if they are kind of a specialized class as in actual, you know, group. So that was going on. And then that's probably coming back now because it was the Trump administration that ended that, but the Trump administration waited about 2 years to end it. And I do think that a lot of things like that were due to Trump simply not knowing what was going on. Like, I mean, that's just like, that there were so many things that the Obama administration got started in its 8 years, right? That included, and it took a while for a lot of this stuff to end. It took a while for the Trump administration to say, oh, we actually had to do something about that. We had to stop these hate yourself white people classes, for whatever you want to call them. Critical race theory is hate indoctrination. It is. And it is still happening in schools. You have like this weird kind of thing going on where leftists increasingly claim that critical race theory is not taught in schools. And then whenever any sort of conservative or traditionalist group tries to remove it from schools, then suddenly they start screaming, how could you do that? How racist you are. It's like, well, I thought it wasn't in schools. Or another one is where they claim that, well, it's in schools, but it's not that big of a deal. And then you try and get rid of it, and then suddenly it's the biggest deal in the world. And anybody who tries to get rid of it is an evil racist bigot. It's like, okay, if it's not a big part of the class, if it doesn't actually affect people's way that they see themselves in an instructive manner, as they claim, if it's they're not doing any of that, then why on earth do they have a problem with its removal? Well, because in fact, it is still in schools, and it is a big deal. And they know the importance of indoctrinating children when they're young. People keep sending me, actually, the Washington State quarantine consultants. See, this is there's job hiring applications that keep coming up online, and I don't think it's just Washington, but most of them are, and you can see these things, and so I thought I'd go ahead and bring it to your attention real quick. See, okay, I think we lost audio for a second there, sorry about that, but in any case, you see these job applications showing up, and they're pretty disturbing, because you see they're for isolation areas, quarantine facilities, and I've also seen at the same time that you've had these quarantine facilities kind of showing up in areas of Canada, especially in Quebec. We talked about it, I think, maybe a year ago. They were talking about putting people there who refused to quarantine themselves. And now we're also seeing some of that over in England, where they're talking about people who refuse to self-isolate. And thing is, we're getting toward, I don't want to talk about COVID for an extended period tonight, but we are getting toward flu season, so I do expect some of this stuff to increase. Victor Davis Hansen recently said the military academy was the most progressive school he's lectured at. That doesn't surprise me. I think there is an active effort in order to take control of the United States military. And that's kind of interesting because the people who you consider entering military service are not people who generally would be leftist, right? The people who come from middle and even lower class backgrounds, they're not the sort of, they don't fit into that kind of mindset generally, but you know, you take them and you put them through enough college style education. You know what I mean? It's like they, like for example, the college system. Everybody knows at this point is designed to make people turn left, right? It's designed to basically indoctrinate people into that sort of a mindset, and it works. I mean, there's so many, like, over the years of me doing these videos, I've received so many different messages from parents who said that they sent their kids into colleges as conservatives or traditionalists or what have you, and they came out as, like, communists, or they were going to Antifa events or what have you, and they have no idea what happened to their kids. Like it or not, the indoctrination actually does work. And the thing is that the colleges kind of miss this massive segment of the population, that is, those who go into the military, generally speaking. A lot of them don't have a college education, traditionally. And now that's sort of changing, because going into the college, going into the military, they're actually being indoctrinated with the very same stuff that has been kind of perfected inside of the military, and so inside of the colleges. That's what's been going on. Penske File says, I don't want to say this, but mostly whites are in the combat arms field. Right. And, well, yeah, that's part of what I meant when I was talking about the type of people that traditionally sign up into the into military service, right? I mean, typically speaking, you've got the man who is white and who is middle to lower class on the income scale. I mean, that's just typical. It doesn't mean that's everything, but that is typical. And that's an area of people they consider to vote in the area of a conservative. And they're trying to change those people, like it or not. And when it comes to colleges, I don't think a lot of people realize just how bad they are. They're like, well, my kid, you know, believes the things that I believe, the things that I've taught, and therefore if I send the kid to this college program, nothing's going to happen, because what could happen, because I know my kid. And it's like, no. And then Becky comes home with blue hair, and nothing's the same again, you know, has lost her faith in everything else. It's really tragic, because they destroy lives. And I mean that because, I mean, if you look at the lives that are led by people who are, you know, leftist, they're not happy lives. I mean, seriously, they're not. I mean, you've got the blue-haired Becky woman, right, who has, let's say, abandoned her faith, which is, you know, pretty common, and then she goes and makes very leftist lifestyle choices, the you do you, and before you know it, she's the kind of washout single mother somewhere who's, you know, in a really bad shape. And it's like, you have the current leftist institutions are destroying lives by teaching kids a sort of inverse of morality, by teaching them to make decisions that they'll then have to live with for the rest of their lives. Anyway, this is really getting kind of far off where we were. But in any case, let's go ahead and move on. And yes, to the person who asked, I am aware that hospitals around the country are firing people for refusing to take the vaccines. I am aware. And it always fascinated me when medical professionals refuse such things. It always seems like they have information that ought to make them able to make their own to make better decisions. But anyway, we won't stay on that topic for long. Speaking of the colleges, actually, I do want to share something with you. There is a professor at UCLA, or he was before he was suspended. His name is Gordon Klein, and he was suspended for not grading black students more leniently than white students, or not grading them better, you might say. So this was actually a really interesting case, because left-wing activists requested that black students were graded better. They wrote him this letter, and it said because of the unjust murders, by their terms, of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, because of those unjust murders, you know, by their estimation, well, this college professor, Gordon Klein, ought to then give better grades to black students than white students. And he refused. And of course, this is a UCLA professor, okay? He's not someone who's on the far right. Let's not be ridiculous, all right? And so he goes ahead, Gordon Klein does, and he responds to this leftist activist group. And his response is kind of snarky. which, frankly, is generous at best, because you'd think maybe he'd just ignore them or say go to hell or something. But instead, he says, thanks for your suggestion in your email that I give black students special treatment, given the tragedy in Minnesota. Do you know the names of the classmates that are black? How can I identify them since we've been having online classes only? And are there any students of mixed parentage, such as half black and half Asian? What do you suggest I do with respect to them? A full concession or just half? And, you know, I gotta say, touche to the professor for pointing out the ridiculousness and absurdity of it. Because you know the way that actually is done, right? It's always, well, if somebody is half black, if we're going to entertain the term, well, then they're black and therefore they get the concession and so on. And yeah, it ought to be kind of perverse. I would think it would be perverse if I were black and were being graded better because I was black. Like I guess I have to kind of go ahead and accept a sort of victimhood class in order for me to speak about this topic freely, because otherwise, you know, I'll find myself in trouble. So how about this? If, on the basis of me being a woman, I was given better grades, I would not feel comfortable therein. In fact, I would feel like my professor was saying that women were incapable of performing as well as men, because that's exactly what he would be saying, right? And so you would think that these people would be offended, like the black students in this case would be offended, but no. He goes on to say in this letter, and he's actually, I don't know if I said, but he's a professor of accounting at UCLA. And he finished it off by saying, also, do you have any idea if any students are from Minneapolis? I assume that they probably are especially devastated as well, given the Minneapolis riots. So I'm thinking that a white student from there might possibly be even more devastated by this, especially because some might think that they're racist even though they're not. End quote. Now, that letter that was sent in response to the leftist activist group was then passed throughout the student body by the activist group. Well, after that, he was suspended, and the school, in a very typical manner for modern times, decided to go ahead and slander his character on social media and talk about how he clearly doesn't believe in equality for all, whereas we, you know, this at UCLA obviously do. That's what happened. So now he's actually suing UCLA for slandering him and for suspending him unjustly, when in fact, you know, he's a pretty leftist professor as far as I can gather. You know, he certainly isn't someone that you could look at and say, oh, he's obviously far right, or, you know, however you want to kind of define that, or is especially racialized. This is a guy who was like, I just want to grade people on the basis of their report and of what they write and of what their, you know, exam results are, and I don't even know the race of these people because the courses are taking place online. And that's really kind of comical. It's like he'd have to first, you know, send out messages to the people filling in the courses saying, what race are you? Because that way I can give you a better grade. And that's actually what the leftist group was seeking, to actually grade them on a curve such that you have other races, I guess white people, and probably Asians too, would be given kind of like an anti-grade of sorts, which would happen as a result of when you bump someone else's grade up, you have to result in pulling somebody else down. I mean, that's the nature of it. And so whatever you say, okay, black students and these other races. I'm not really sure what other races there would be, because it seems like Asians tend to get the short end of the stick when it comes to academia, at least, and racial profiling in that regard. So probably just blacks. But in any case, yeah. Cal DeFranco says accounting is problematic. Well, yeah, when it comes to professors, you often do have conservatives in that field, especially, yeah, more than most. But he certainly wasn't taking a pro-white perspective, I wouldn't say. Just I'm going to grade you based upon what you send in. All right. Spartan on DLive says, Asians and whites did take a college to court for discriminating against them. Yes, that is true, and it was Harvard. And, you know, it's still going on. Honestly, the Biden administration have sided with the college, with Harvard, repeatedly, because, you know, they're discriminating against Asians and whites, and those racial groups don't matter. that's not what they said, but that's implicitly what they said because that's what they believe. Basically, we're living in a culture that increasingly says that that you can be racist against whites and it doesn't matter because whites are the oppressors and always will be. Speaking of academia, though, the National School Boards Association, which is a leftist organization, is asking for federal law enforcement to intervene against threats to their members. Now, apparently parents nationwide are boiling over about two things: mask mandates and critical race theory being taught in schools. Parents are basically fighting back in large scale, which is good to hear. Now, this one group, the National School Board Association, is intentionally conflating threats of violence with simply public criticism. And I saw this repeatedly. I keep reading these different articles, and they're talking about they're threatening behavior and so on. And I keep checking, and it's like, but that's not a threat. That's just someone criticizing you and, you know, trying to hold you responsible. It's not the same thing. But this is something that the active left have been doing for some time, where they are attempting to use the word, like, attack. They have kind of redefined it in modern colloquial usage, such that everyone who hears it has no idea what somebody means. And I think I covered this, like, a year and a half ago or something. But the left has been doing it because they claim that words are violence, that speech is violence. And the thing is that when you claim that speech is violence, you basically mean that everyone has a right to self-defense. What does that mean? Well, it means that if you go up to somebody and you use the wrong pronoun, let's just use an example they might like, use the wrong pronoun to talk to a person, they might claim that speech is violence, and therefore they have a right to retaliate against you and hit you. Because it's just self-defense. And that's kind of what's going on in academia. They've been kind of redefining such words. So when they say so-and-so attacked me, they might actually not mean that the person attacked, but rather criticized. And increasingly they're saying, well, it doesn't really matter, they're the same thing. And if you ask around at a college campus, you will find a lot of students who are unable to distinguish between actual violence and between criticism. And it's jarring to hear these students who supposedly are educated in some fashion be unable to distinguish. But that's what the kind of modern system is teaching now. Chief Toad says, all leftists now say speech is violence. Well, yeah, exactly. And they're doing it intentionally so they can justify retaliation. That's what it's really about. And so whenever they talk about it, increasingly, I've been trying to kind of stop myself from falling into their trap by using words like attack instead of, you know, critique or criticism. Okay, let's go ahead and move on. Caden Liam says, I'm sorry if you may have been asked about it, but what are your thoughts on the Canadian election that happened last week? I found it entirely unsurprising because it is I did cover it last week, but to summarize, basically you have a mostly two-party system over there in which neither party are worth voting for. And therefore, I don't see any sort of surprise in the fact that Trudeau won, because I don't see why anybody would even show up. I mean, you could vote for something like the PPC, you know, which is decent, but it's seen as so minor in comparison to the other two major parties that most people aren't going to show up. It also has a name that's sounds kind of communistic, you know, the People's Party. You immediately think kind of communist or socialist when in fact they're neither. And you look at the so-called Conservative Party over there and the way they've treated these COVID lockdowns, and you don't see it as any better really than Trudeau's party. It's like, well, what would be the point in even showing up? I legitimately don't see the point. And therefore, I'm not surprised in the least. I do feel for the Canadians who live under that system. And I know that a lot of Canadians are suffering over there and are pretty voiceless, which is pretty tragic. And it's a very similar situation that's going on over in England for an extended period of time when you have the Tories or the Conservatives versus Labour, which is the more obviously left party. And it's like they're both just two sides of the same coin. I know that a lot of people will say that the same thing happens here, but I don't think it's anywhere near to the same degree. At least over here, you've got the Conservatives mostly give us lip service. Over there, it's like, no, they'll just continue to stomp on your rights and then just tell you to vote for them for quite literally no reason at all. Okay. I keep getting asked to comment on the OkCupid signs that are showing up in New York subways, so we'll talk about that for a minute. But there's not that much to say, because you've got these different, well, these massive signs put out. OkCupid is a dating site, right? And they're putting out these massive posters that are supposed to be inclusive, and in the leftist sense, which means that they're kind of degenerate. And so you've got these plastered signs, that some of which use really phallic imagery, and all of which are like LGBTQ plus friendly. Let's put it like that. so that we, you know, we can keep this stream up. But in any case, they're like that. And they've got the non-binary people and all of this. And there have been some videos showing people removing the signs from the subway, because you've got, like, you know, kids and stuff riding on these subways. And you've got that kind of degenerate photography up trying to promote that. And it's just wrong. It really is wrong to have the stuff up to begin with. And you think that in a place that, I don't know, it's like a place like New York is a place that pretends to care about its people, right? I mean, seriously, it's a place that's always kind of trying to do something about the salt in the restaurant foods and whether or not you can get a soft drink and where from, because they care so much about the people that live within its borders and so on, right? And so it's that kind of place. And so I always find it kind of interesting. The same vein, they can be like just so involved in people's lives in order to supposedly, if you listen to their messages, make lives better. And then it comes to something like that, where it's like paraphernalia or propaganda that is aimed at normalizing homosexuality and stuff like that to kids, and they just look the other way because that's what modern leftism is that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, you know, you can look at I don't think they have any problem with, for example, the most degenerate gay pride parades, for example, and the sort of overt homosexual sexuality that you see expressed therein. But, you know, not too much salt in your food. That's where they draw the line. What do you even say? New York City is filled with homeless and very dirty streets. Well, yeah, I mean, it just is one of the most leftist places in the nation. You know, Washington, D.C. is worse in that regard. If you look at their voting record, in any case, that is worse in that regard. But, you know, I find it difficult to look at New York City and just be anything but sort of amused, because it's like, if you didn't have places like that where the collective left had such a reign, then you wouldn't perhaps know what the inevitable conclusion of voting for such people would be. But in fact, you can, because you can just look. You can look at Washington, D.C. and New York City and some of the cesspit cities in California, and you can be like, oh, look, we don't want our place to become San Francisco and New York City, and just not vote in that direction. Like, you can see it, you know, just look. And, you know, and yet people don't. And yet the people who live in those places continue to vote for those people until they decide to go and leave and move to Texas or what have you, as often happens. Okay. Moving on. Caden Liam says, if there was a negative to Brexit, you have noticed that all the populist parties like the BNP and UKIP have just evaporated, sorry, and there's no real opposition anymore. Sad. I disagree, actually. I mean, that's not the reason that the BNP disappeared. The BNP sort of imploded from the inside. They couldn't stop fighting each other. There's a lot of stuff there that I won't get into, just because most people wouldn't be able to keep up with it, because we only have a small British audience to begin with. But the UK Independence Party, that is probably true. It did disappear largely because they thought they had won, even though they sort of hadn't. And then they threw their support behind Boris Johnson so that they could perhaps get some kind of a break, so that they could perhaps get the separation that the British people had actually voted for. That's true. But I think one of the big reasons that there isn't a good populist party is that people aren't willing to speak. That's the real issue. Like, back when the BNP was at its most popular, let's say, I don't know, probably 2004, 2005, something in there, is when it had reached its kind of high point from my estimation. When you look back then, well, you had the people who were doing the speaking were honest. I mean, they spoke about what they saw, and they spoke about the Muslim child rape gangs that were going around, and they talked about the immigration in very blunt language, and they had a lot of support in doing so. And there was a lot of public support, public sentiment that they were kind of echoing. And now I think there are people who are afraid, because frankly, you have such a crackdown on speech in England that you prohibit political parties from even existing. I mean, look at the BNP, for example, you mentioned. Well, how much problem did they have then of just having a bank account? I remember they were shut down from, I think, every major British bank except for NatWest, and that was back in 2005. And this was it was the third biggest political party in Britain at that particular point. So 2005, right? It was the biggest. It was the third biggest political party and the fastest growing political party in Britain, and yet they couldn't get a bank because all the banks kept saying, oh, no, we don't want to do anything with you. And this is something that we're going to see happening more and more in America. We're already seeing it happening. It's not just like PayPal, which has cut out tons of different people who do online work and who happen to be conservative. But it's like, even if you look at things like Chase Bank, which has cut down people from Enrique Tarrio to Lauren Witzke, to Gab and so on. If you look at, I think Gab is probably the main company that you can look at and see that they've been kicked out of like a dozen different banks and credit unions. Like everyone says to Gab, well, if you can't, you know, use the banks, then go get a credit union. It's like even the credit unions are cracking down. And most likely the moves against Gab using the banking sector have come from the Biden administration. There was a old policy that was part of the Obama era in which, I'm trying to remember the name of it. There was actually an operation name for it, which the whole idea was to basically get rid of extremists. Yeah, I know. Extremists by Obama's definition, by preventing their ability to do banking. And now it seems to be back under the Biden administration, which was fairly predictable. But very few people realize exactly how far this goes. And it goes to the point where anybody would be afraid to speak because they're afraid to lose their ability to bank and in turn their ability to feed their families. And I think that situation has already arisen over in England. Like, I don't remember if her name is Laura Towler or Fowler. I'm sorry, I think it's Towler. But in any case, I know that she also, for example, lost her ability to have a private bank account. She experienced some degree of terrorism from that. And I mean that in the most literal sense, meaning that she was terrorized by the fact that she couldn't buy groceries because her bank was closed. And they wouldn't tell her why, or give her a straight answer, or give her access to her money. I mean, I don't care who you are or what you're saying, you shouldn't lose the ability to have banking. You shouldn't lose the ability to buy your groceries because of what you're saying. If people don't want to listen to you, they won't. But that doesn't, at no point should you have anybody coming between you and saying, no, you can't have the right to a bank, especially in the times in which we live, where increasingly we're moving toward a cashless society, where you will be required to use a credit or debit card for every transaction so that the government can then track you. And that's what it's about. And so when I see these people who are like, well, it's just happening to this other political figure who I don't really care that much about, it's like, well, okay, it will come to you too, in a similar way to how, okay, you remember after the January 6th protest, right? I think it was, yeah, it was Bank of America that said they were going to offer to law enforcement, they were going to offer the public records, the banking records to law enforcement of everyone who they thought was there, even when they weren't asked with a warrant. Because that's really kind of disturbing to me. Hold on, let me get a drink. I'm talking too much. In any case, that ought to disturb everyone. Because you're talking about a bank conspiring with the government in order to look at people who have been to a protest. Because all Bank of America knew was that those people had gone to Washington, D.C. and bought a hotel ticket or used Uber and so on. That's all they knew. They didn't know that they had engaged in some criminal act because most people hadn't. You know, but they were there volunteering to offer up that information and also apparently canceling some of those accounts. That's the future. The future is that people are afraid to go to a protest because they might lose their ability to bank. And when they lose their ability to bank, they lose their ability to pay for groceries, to pay their bills, to pay their mortgages. And that's stifling. And what you have happening in England isn't so much of an organic loss of third parties. It's an absolute fear by those third parties to speak. It is the fact that the opposition to the mainstream are being persecuted to such a degree that they can't exist. If you look at the leaders of like Britain First, for example, and the persecution that they've received, that kind of stands as testament to what I'm saying also. So that was probably a longer rant than you were expecting, but the time frame in which the BNP died and UKIP was pretty strong too, I'm very familiar with, and what was going on in the banking sector around that time. I do think that it's kind of fortuitous of what's going on in America today. Okay, let me just move down to where you guys are. There we go. Alan Wade says, all these businesses need to be beware, because people will remember when conservatives are back in power. What goes around comes around. Well, it really doesn't, though. I mean, generally speaking, you don't have, when Republicans are in power, they don't act in this way. Like, you don't have anything equivalent to the IRS going after the Tea Party during the Obama administration. Like, there was nothing even remotely equivalent to that when you had the Trump administration, you know, around. There just wasn't. And there never is, because the people who are, you know, calling themselves Republicans and conservatives are people who are at least espousing moral values and decency and so on. And so when they go in and they get some degree of power, they then try to some degree at least, and I know it's not perfect, but at least to some degree, that they try and act as if they care about those values. And so they don't act in unfair manners, at least not when there's like no profit motive, which, you know, we're talking politicians here, so I'm trying to be careful exactly what I say here, but you know. says crypto is the answer. I have no need for banks. Well, I mean, at some point you end up having to cash it out, unless every company around is going to use cryptocurrency, and that just isn't the reality. More disturbingly, I think that if we were at a point to where you could do everything with cryptocurrency, it would be made illegal. And then its kind of value would plummet overnight. So I'm really reticent to tell people to, you know, put too much faith into that system, because it could just be destroyed in a very rapid manner. And I don't want people to risk that. I do think it's interesting to look at who the most kind of evil people in our society are, what they're buying. You know, like, you got the Bill Gates of the world, who's like buying up all the different land. It's like, okay, well, at least that, you know, wouldn't lose its value overnight and be made illegal, most likely, right? So yeah, I do think that's a particularly interesting point. And I do hear that also, this isn't Bill Gates, but there are a lot of different Chinese buyers now of property that's kind of creating little housing crises at different areas throughout the United States. And few people seem to be paying attention to it, but you have like Chinese companies that are buying up like apartment complexes en masse, these massive multinational corporations based in China, and then increasing the pricing on it such that basically people can't even pay their rent. And that's disastrous for the people who can't pay their rent, obviously. But it's also fascinating that we have these Chinese companies that are buying up land and property in America at the same time that you've got, you know, some of the most evil people in our country also buying such things. I think it's worth paying attention to. Okay, I should probably wrap up this stream soon, because, well, it is past the hour, but if you guys have any last topics that you want me to cover, just go ahead and type them in, and we will chat for a few more minutes. But in any case, I'm just kind of giving you the early warning here that I'm going to end this pretty soon. In the meantime, I will say Pastor Arthur, I think it's pronounced, even though it's spelled Arthur, over in Canada has been rearrested again. His persecution is constantly ongoing, it would seem. I did do an interview with him. It was certainly one of the better interviews I've done with him, as Arthur Pavlovsky, that is, who is being, persecuted for his willingness to actually do the Christian thing, you know, to actually open the church, regardless of what the authorities say, to actually feed the poor, regardless of what the authorities say. He's a really good man, and he's doing good work, he is. Wish I could do more for him. Jennifer says, why can't I donate? If you mean in the live chat thing, it's because this whole channel was demonetized a while back because, well, they punished me for a year-old video about, what's his name, Kyle Rittenhouse, that I did. If you want to hear about what actually happened, there's a video that I put on all the non-YouTube platforms, like, you know, BitChute and GabTV and Odyssey and... And there's another one, Rumble, yeah, technically exists. There's a video about it there. But yeah, basically the whole channel got demonetized, so you can't do live chat donations. You can still donate. There's information in the description below. Thank you, by the way. But yeah. Okay, and... all right. Okay, guys, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap this up, but I do appreciate you joining me tonight. It has been a good night, and I think we kind of covered a lot. We certainly did, so